Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Made on Purpose. Well, here we are, another episode of Made on Purpose. And today we have Michael Yeshdishin with us. And Michael is a husband, a father, and a sergeant with the RCMP.
Yes.
So thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time and being willing to share some of your story. I love that everybody has a story. And when you look at someone, you're like, why are they the way they are? And, you know, you have to, there's this element of remembering there's things that have happened in their life that have contributed to who they are, right? So it gives a level of grace and a level of understanding. But so thankful that you're here to share your story with us. And why don't you introduce yourself a little bit? Tell us about yourself.
Sure. So I grew up in Markham, Ontario, which is just outside of Toronto, just north of it. Went to school there, grade school, high school, went to college in downtown Toronto. Didn't stay there too long. I was a lifeguard for a while as well growing up.
Right.
It had a really big impact on me. I started at the absolute bottom of that. I started off cleaning change rooms.
Okay.
And then kind of worked my way up and started teaching swimming on a volunteer basis, worked with special needs kids, regular classes, all that stuff. Eventually became an instructor, head guard, supervisor, and started kind of running a shift and everything. And, got lots of really good experience there,
mm-hmm.
Both in high school and while I was going to college. And, like I said, I didn't last there. I didn't last too long. I was, 19 when I applied to the RCMP,
okay.
And then 20 when I got in.
Wow.
I was quite young, and then graduated shortly after I turned 21.
Yeah.
So I at the time hadn't really finished college. I only had a couple of years. I got in a lot sooner than I anticipated.
Yeah.
But that's kind of a snapshot.
Yeah, for sure. As a child, was being a police officer something that you had like on your bucket list, like your dream?
It was something I wanted to do. I really wasn't sure what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
I kept changing my mind. I wanted to be a marine biologist, and then I wanted to be a paramedic, an engineer, a teacher. I kept changing my mind. I never really committed to anything too much. But as I got older and I kind of started to settle, I thought, you know, policing, I think, is something for me.
Yeah.
Something that my dad had done for many, many years.
Okay.
He retired with 40 years on the job.
So, oh, my.
Yeah. He put in a lot of time.
So you would have known what this is going to entail if you were to join the force.
Strangely, not as much as you would think.
Okay.
I knew a little bit about it, but he, his career was very different than mine. So he... He applied and got in when he was younger as well. And he had a university degree, which back then was quite uncommon. And then he went right into some of the federal units. So most of his time was working major projects. Taking down bikers and meth labs and that kind of stuff in downtown Toronto.
Yeah.
And some other areas as well. And then he moved on to, he did a whole bunch of wiretap stuff. Lots of high-level kind of drug trafficking type investigations. He also ended up going into counterterrorism, terrorism financing, that kind of stuff. So a lot of what he did, he never actually talked to me about very much.
Yeah.
And even once I became a police officer, because a lot of what he dealt with was kind of a need-to-know basis.
Right.
So I, even though I was a police officer, I wasn't actually privy to that particular information. So
right.
I knew a little bit about the lifestyle, but with the RCMP, there's such a broad scope of what that can look like.
Yeah.
So
you're right. It is huge, right? And like even with frontline policing, there's so many departments. Like there's the dog unit, and then I'm going to show my ignorance because now I've run short of like what else is there, but I could just like, there's so many different things you could do.
Yeah. There is quite a bit. There's, more of the frontline stuff. You're looking at, general duty, which is kind of your contract policing. You're responding to calls. You're dealing with situations as they unfold. And you've got your crime reduction team. So they're more of like a street enforcement type stuff. Mostly proactive. Your dog guys. community police officers, less so on the enforcement side. They're more kind of building relationships with community members and different groups. There's dozens and dozens of different groups within the RCMP. So
yeah, well, that's I'm thinking about the age of when you signed up mm-hmm. and started your training. Like you said, 19.
19 is when I applied.
When you applied,
then, yeah, they accepted me. The application process at the time was quite lengthy, mm-hmm. which was probably for the better.
Yeah.
But I was I was 20 when I got in. I started training in Regina at Devil.
Yeah. Yeah, which is actually pretty fantastic. Like I think of my own kids. I've got a 20-year-old and then 18 and 16. And that people always expect, you know, coming out of high school that you know exactly what you're going to do and what are you going to university for and all of that. But to step into something at that young of an age and now to have built a career and not shifted paths, that's actually pretty remarkable.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's very, very interesting. So obviously, you're wired for that.
Yeah, it's. I still remember when I signed up for training and I started doing it. I got in. I definitely felt overwhelmed at times, mm-hmm. but what I used to kind of counterbalance that was not to so much look at the end goal of you're going to be a cop, you're going to get, you know, a gun and a badge, you're going to have all this responsibility, all this stuff, but just one day at a time. Mm. Every day that I can check off and say that I've finished is another day on my belt for training. Every test I pass is another notch in the belt. So I kind of just piecemealed it that way, which made it a lot more manageable.
Yeah.
And then never quitting.
Great.
Even though I wanted to a couple times.
Yeah. Well, when you take the option mentally, you take your option of quitting away, it's amazing what you can accomplish. Like you tend to have more endurance than you expect to.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's played into some other areas of my life too.
Yeah. Which we're going to get into too. So, okay. So you're working with the RCMP and it was pretty early on in your career that you started to have some warning signs.
Yes, so I started off in North Battleford. I was just shy of 3.5 years having worked there.
Mm-hmm.
Policing was my life at the time. That's all I did.
Right.
I'd work and work and work. I worked. I'd go in on my own time, and do mm-hmm. voluntary overtime for many, many hours. I definitely wouldn't do that now with a family,
right.
But at the time I was trying to build my career and it certainly helped me.
Yeah.
I managed to get myself into a drug unit in Fort McMurray coming out of there. And then not long after that, maybe a year and a half, I started getting some vision problems in my right eye, but only the right eye. So what it looked like was with both eyes open, I actually couldn't tell that anything was wrong, but every now and again, you'd rub your eye when you're tired or whatever it is, or if you have something in it. So I'd rub my good eye and my bad eye would be open. And I'd notice there was a tiny little blur, just the size of a small, like the eraser on a pencil.
Right.
Right in the center field of my vision. And at first I thought it was just too much screen time or maybe I needed glasses or something innocuous, but it got progressively worse. And then I ended up seeing specialist who put me on some medication that helped initially. It's called prednisone. It's basically anti-inflammatory. So unbeknownst to me, I had a tumor at the time there. So the medication somewhat reduced the inflammation, but of course was never going to be a cure for that. So it made it better, but then it just continued to get worse after. So they sent me to another specialist in Edmonton. And I went to go see him, and I remember this being later in the evening because I was one of his last patients, and the conversation he and I had was definitely, it stood out to me as being unusual because he, on the spot, sent me to the hospital to get an MRI, and I thought to myself, well, that's not normal.
No, not normal at all, hey?
No, especially to get one so quick. Normally MRIs take weeks or months for people to get, so for him to order it so quickly was somewhat concerning. And then I asked him, well, you know, you're going to be closed when I come back. What are we going to do here? And he basically said, well, no, I'll stick around, I'll wait. So I'm thinking to myself, okay, I'm probably not going to get back here till, you know, 7, 8 o'clock. Like this is, this isn't good. this is not going well. So I went over, got the MRI zipped back to his office. I still remember the look on his face. Him and his assistant, they were both there, and he closed the door and just had this somber look on his face. And he said, we found a tumor in the MRI. And I wasn't even upset at that point because I kind of knew it was coming. I was almost like, ha, I knew it. So I should be far more upset than I am right now, but I knew it. I was right.
Yeah.
So, I called my boss, called my family, said, hey, I'm going to be here for a little bit. And my family, my parents, at the time were still in Toronto, or in Markham. So, there's not much they could do. They were quite a ways away. So, I went into the hospital the following day, met with another specialist there, Dr. Weiss, absolutely phenomenal doctor. I couldn't have had a better doctor, really. Yeah. So he, in any event, he operated on me and he did a biopsy. So he basically went in through kind of the corner of the eye, made an incision in the optic nerve, the tumor poured out. He took part of it out and sampled it.
Mm-hmm.
And it came back as being low grade. So low grade is good with optic nerve gliomas, which is ultimately what I ended up having. So low grade means it grows slowly, versus high grade, which grows fast.
Mm-hmm.
High grade is fatal. Low grade is curable. It's treatable. So then I kind of just carried on. I was told it was low grade. We're just going to monitor it. We'll move on from here. I went back to work. I was running. I was weightlifting. Everything was fine. And then it started to get worse. Mm-hmm. My vision was getting blurrier. I went in for an MRI again. They did another follow-up one a few weeks later, and it had grown exponentially, the tumor. Mm. So then at that point, things kind of started to go sideways. So they told me, we're going to do a surgery. We're going to take out as much as we can without completely removing the nerve. So hopefully we can save some of your vision. And then once you've recovered from the surgery, then we'll do radiation. Every day for about a month and a half,
mm-hmm.
at a fairly high dose. It was kind of a messed up decision at that point because they presented me with two options.
Right.
The first was we can go with a higher dose of radiation, which has a higher probability of curing the cancer, but also a higher probability of getting cancer down the road.
Right.
Or a lower dose of radiation, which again, lower probability of curing cancer and then a lower chance of getting it later. Mm. I ultimately opted to go with a higher dose, just thinking, let's deal with what we have now.
If
I get cancer, 20 years from now, medicine, the way it's advancing, I'll probably be more likely to survive. So let's just deal with the immediate problem. So I went through that. The numbers I had at the time weren't really good.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of the first real gut punch I had with this whole situation. They ended up telling me that for me to live another 10 years, I had about a 55% chance to do that.
Wow.
So I didn't really know how to react to that.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do with that? That's almost a 50% chance that you're going to live or die.
Right.
Do I get married? Do I have kids? Do I carry on the same way at work? What do you do? I mean, if they told me I had 6 months to live, that'd be very different. I have a much better idea of what I would do. But something like that, it was kind of just a really weird, and I was fine up until I heard that. So I'd been asking the doctor all these different questions, the cancer, what it was, what it would look like, treatment plan, recovery, all that kind of stuff. But when I got those numbers, that's when I just kind of crumpled.
Yeah.
I managed to make it through that. And then what I learned with radiation is you can actually go through it. At least in my case, I was able to go through it and for the most part, carry on with my day. I was able to work out. I was able to go for runs. I was able to carry on in my schoolwork that I was doing. I was part-time university at the time. Actually still am. All these things were fine, but as it carried on, I was getting much more tired. The pain was getting a lot worse because it's kind of like a slow burn.
Mm-hmm.
So the peak of the pain isn't actually as you're going through it, it's probably, if I remember correctly, it's about 2 or 3 weeks after your last dose.
Oh, man.
No different than a burn. You burn yourself on the stove. It's you know, however many hours or days later that the worst of it hits. So I was going through that, and I was in excruciating pain. It wasn't hitting a plateau and coming down. It just kept going. So they gave me a very high dose of prednisone, and assuming it was the inflammation that was causing the problem and the pain and everything else. It turns out it wasn't. So I was getting these very minute symptoms that were coming back, tingling on my head. I still had some very minimal vision. I could detect movement. If I covered my good eye and was looking through my bad, I could detect movement, but it was almost like it was getting darker.
Right.
So these very minor symptoms. But I decided to go get checked out, and I was coming off the prednisone as well. So the pain hadn't hit yet, but I had all these other little things I was noticing. So I go to the hospital, and at first the doctor couldn't really tell what was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was in Toronto and visiting my family, and I was in Markham, and I went to one of the kind of local hospitals.
Yeah.
And they took a look. They couldn't quite figure it out, and they pretty much told me straight out, look, like, we don't have a full neuro facility here. We're not really sure what's going on. So I called up my my oncologist, and they spoke to him in Alberta, and you could just see their faces widening as they're like, their eyes widening as they're talking to him. And they basically, after that conversation, said, look, this could be very severe, and we don't have anywhere near the ability to deal with this here. You need to go to somewhere that has like a neuro unit. So I ended up going to one of the major hospitals in Toronto. Went there, saw the eMERGE doctor, explained kind of the medical history. He couldn't see anything, but, you know, grudgingly told me to come back the following day to see one of the resident neurosurgeons or ophthalmologists, I believe. I can't remember which. It was New Year's Day, so I don't think he was in the best of moods, which is okay. And I just watched him finish dealing with someone who was very clearly trying to get pain medication off of him, and he was having none of it. So I was thinking to myself, look, I'm not the same person here. I'm not looking for pain meds. I just want to make sure I'm okay.
Yeah.
So he made an appointment for me. I came back the following day, and they examined me. It was a really almost surreal experience, because she's going through all the testing with me, almost like she's checking boxes, like, yeah, uh-huh, okay. Just completely neutral, very pleasant.
Right.
And then finally moves the last piece of machinery away and says, okay, you're bleeding from the back four quadrants of the eye. Your tumor's grown significantly. We're going to have to check you in right away. And that caught me off guard. And I'm thinking to myself, not again. Like, so they booked me into the hospital. Instead of the resident, I then get a number of different surgeons that come in. There are ophthalmologists, neurosurgeons, because with the optic nerve, it kind of goes into the area of the brain as well. So there's you need multiple types of specialists to deal with this.
Right.
So, but in any event, one of them at one point came in and gave me kind of a rundown of what to expect. And one of the things she kept sticking to was that I would survive the surgery, which to me was a very abnormal thing. Like, that's your selling point.
Right.
How much time do I have here? So I pushed her for it. You could tell she wasn't comfortable talking about it, but I pushed her for it. And basically I was told I had between 2 months and 2 years to live.
Wow.
Max. I completely fell apart. I was just utterly gutted at that point. Probably the lowest point in my life, I would say, was that.
Yeah.
I can't think of anything that even comes close to how bad that was. But yeah, I managed to get through that. And I came back to Alberta. I had an amazing team of doctors here, and there was no detriment to holding off. So I decided, you know, if a few days travel isn't going to make a difference, I might as well book some flights, get back here and get these guys to operate, because they've been nothing short of miraculous with some of the other stuff they've done. So,
right.
So yeah, I got back here. They performed a craniotomy. So they cut all along the side of the head, peeled the skin down, took part of the skull out, lifted the brain.
Wow.
Resected the optic nerve, some of the surrounding tissue. It was about a 7-hour procedure. Absolutely crippling. I think it was about 3 or 4 days before I could walk again. And then I did get some good news though with that. So they told me that it looks like it's a low grade tumor. We don't see any high grade margins. Everything's low grade. So the exterior is all low grade. We still need to send it off for analysis because some tumors can have multiple compositions. They can be both low and high grade. And if there's a high grade component, you're still kind of hooped.
Right.
So every day waiting by the phone was not fun.
No.
Because they said they'd call me as soon as they had news. And the longer it took, the better. So every day I was just super anxious, waiting by the phone, hoping it wasn't going to ring. Every time someone else called or messaged, I'd freak out because I'm thinking, oh, is it them? No, okay, it's not them. Okay, good.
Right. You want to hear from them, but you don't want to hear from them.
Exactly.
And it's, yeah, not nice.
Yeah. So then it was just shy of 3 weeks when my doctor had called. The neurosurgeon who performed the, who was one of the doctors who performed the surgery. And he basically said over the phone, hey, I got the results. I wanted to call you right away.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be fine. It's low grade. All of it's low grade. I don't remember what he said after that because I just completely fell apart again.
Yeah.
I didn't even process it. I just, it's like I went into this like haze almost.
Yeah.
I was like in this fog and then
like the weight is lifted. Hey,
yeah.
All of a sudden.
I was an absolute mess, but then I was of course very happy and started to slowly kind of digest.
Yeah.
What the implications of that were, but then that created another fight for me.
Yes, it did.
Yes. Because I ended up getting permanently blinded in my right eye when they removed the optic nerve. So, complete blindness in my right eye. I don't see anything out of it. Still to this day, don't and likely never will. And as you can imagine, being a police officer, that has certain ramifications. So the medical policy at the time, the vision standard policy, essentially forced me to be administrative only, to work at a desk for the rest of my career. And at this point, I think I had, I want to say maybe 6 years on the job. So I was absolutely not ready to write a desk.
To push paper.
No, and that's not what I signed up for.
Yeah.
And I understood why they did it. But as time went on, I started to push harder and started to sort of reorganize myself mentally in a way. Because initially, you know, I was so relieved from being done with cancer and I didn't quite care too much about getting back to work
yet. It's like, I'm going to live. Nothing else matters right now.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm just going to focus on that for a bit.
Yeah.
And then, but yeah, I mean, time was going on. I was exercising lots. I was getting better. I was eating super healthy. I was feeling really good. And I was starting to think to myself that I can do this. I know I can do this. I just need them to give me the chance, which they weren't willing to do because of the, you know, the ramifications that can go without the liability and the perception of liability and all that. So that turned into a giant battle for about 4 years. So I went through it in a number of different ways. So the first thing that I did and that I'd kind of been doing throughout was lots of physical training. If I was going to be blind in one eye, I wanted to compensate in every way that I could for the vision loss.
Right.
So I continued with lots of training, running, lifting. I started doing Brazilian jiu-jitsu, which I wish I had done it years ago because jiu-jitsu is absolutely amazing.
Yes.
The sense of spatial awareness that it gives you is unreal. It really is a thing. And through that, I was actually, that's one of the ways that I was able to relearn depth perception. So when you have vision in both eyes, you have a certain number of visual cues.
Right.
When you're blind in one eye, you lose some of those cues, but not all of them. So you can retrain the remaining ones to essentially relearn depth perception. And one of the things that people wouldn't understand through no fault of their own. It's not something that people typically deal with.
Yeah.
But depth perception is only from arm's length away.
Okay.
So from here to here, that's where depth perception comes into play. Anything past that is a monocular task. So if I'm judging distances from this house to that one, I don't know, 50 meters,
right,
I'd say, I don't need two eyes to do that. You can do that with one eye. That's how I'm able to drive and do all these other things that I do, or even just grab this coffee and not, you know,
right,
do one of these, because I've retrained myself,
mm-hmm,
for it. And then monocular, it was never an issue. So then, ironically, there are some people still saying no, even though I had, by this point, I'd gone on a whole bunch of courses. I'd taken the taser course again.
Yeah.
I did all the scenarios, passed them without any issue. I went to block training, did all of the recertifications, destroyed every physical test that they had. I did all these things, and they still said no. And I kind of started to realize that this was going to be more of an academic game than
right,
a physical one.
Yeah.
So a few interesting things happened all at once. The first was they gave me a duty to accommodate position.
Right.
Duty to accommodate legislation is basically something that came into effect however many years ago, where employers can't just arbitrarily get rid of someone if they end up incurring a disability. They have to keep them employed, provided that person can still reasonably do some level of work. And there's a whole bunch of other stipulations that go with it, but that's kind of what that is in a nutshell. So even with policing, even if you can't do frontline, there's still lots of stuff that you can do.
Mm-hmm. This time though, Michael, like I was just thinking, when you were running into this resistance to be able to resume the job that you had before this all happened, mm-hmm, a lot of people would have been like, okay, now I'm blind in one eye. I will find an appropriate job. You know, I guess it's not policing, so I'll find something else that I can have some joy in anyways. But obviously, like by that time you said you had 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
So you must have sort of loved your job.
I did.
By then.
I did.
Yeah.
I loved what I did. Certainly had its moments that sucked, but
yeah,
it really is a great job.
Yeah.
It's unfortunately very politicized nowadays, but
yeah,
it is one of those jobs where you can really do a lot of good in it,
mm,
and it's what you make of it.
Right.
And it's how you perceive it as well. You're going to get a lot of calls that are just kind of nonsense,
mm-hmm,
calls that aren't really police matters, or it's, you know, the same two people at it again kind of thing. You still have to go and deal with it and stay professional and all that kind of stuff, even though you're not really making a huge difference. But there are calls and moments and opportunities that you can take advantage of where you, mm-hmm, really can have a huge effect on someone.
Yeah.
And that's something I really liked with policing, mm-hmm, especially with the RCMP. We had lots of latitude, provided we did our job and took our share of calls and everything else. We really have a lot of latitude to take on a lot of extra things if we so choose.
Right.
And I kind of going off of that line, it was almost like it took away my ability to do good things for others.
Okay.
And of course, there's lots of ways that can be done.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, that was that was my way of doing it.
Yeah.
Was through that. And I felt like that was taken away from me. So
yeah,
even though I could go and do all these other meaningful things, it's still, and I still recognized objectively, I recognized some of those things were good, but it wasn't the same.
Right. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's a huge part of what motivated me to keep on this battle, because there
right,
were so many times where I just wanted to give up.
Yeah.
And so many times where, for all intents and purposes, I did. I would just pick myself up after.
Yeah.
So a few interesting things had happened.
Mm-hmm.
The first of which was they give me a duty to accommodate position,
yeah,
in the tactical training unit. So the irony of that is that I then became a firearms instructor, tactics instructor, did all these different things, took all these RCMP courses. They have different acronyms, BFI, PEPSIC, IARD, all that stuff. But basically very, very tactical courses at an instructor level,
mm-hmm,
that I took after the vision loss. So I didn't have these courses before.
Right.
I lost my eye, I got DESP, then they put me there, and then I took these courses and passed them. despite the blindness in one eye. So that contributed towards my arguments, showing that, hey, I've adapted. Had I not adapted, there's no way I could have been successful at these courses, especially the shooting ones where you're, you know, targets at varying distances. You've got all these safety considerations, angles of fire, all these different things that are essentially, you know, visual tasks.
Right.
Even the tactics course, the PEPSIC course, there's so much going on where you're running use of force scenarios, where you're observing them, where you're doing them yourself at an elevated level from what would be required from just kind of a regular police officer, and then being successful with those. But I still knew that I needed more. So I ended up securing the assistance of my my ophthalmologist, Dr. Weiss. I flat out asked him, is this something you would support me with? Because I want to do this and I know I can do it. Would you back me up on it, basically? And he did. He fully agreed that it's something that I would be capable of doing. I thought it was going to be a bit more of an argument than that, but I was really relieved to see his support for me, which was a huge thing. And then I also started, I had started before actually, but I continued on with the research that I was doing. So I pulled all of the research studies that formed the parameters of their standards for vision. And at the time I was still working through university courses. And so I started to take some electives that would help me with that. So courses where I'd have to write papers, do independent research, critical thinking, presenting arguments, those kind of things. So I really tried to focus in on elective courses that would kind of be focused in those areas of academics. And I was able to really attack and show the limitations of a lot of those studies, because there's very little data on monocular vision. There's just,
right.
It's not like there's a huge pool of people to draw from for, especially for policing. There are actually no studies on policing with monocular vision.
Wow.
Which doesn't surprise me, because it's just something that's never really been done before. So I started going outside of the kind of typical peer-reviewed medical journals that I was looking at, because the places that I went for that information just didn't have what I was looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to find police officers in the States predominantly who were blind in one eye. There's no one in the RCMP that had done this, but there were a number of police officers in the States and one in Winnipeg who had done policing with vision loss in one eye. And I literally tracked these people down,
mm-hmm.
and explained who I was, what I was trying to do, and asked them if I could more or less use them as a case study. And I wanted to show that this could be a thing. So I kind of focused on, you know, their job duties and how comparable they were to mine, or what mine would be if I were to go back.
Mm-hmm.
The situations that they've been in, and many of them had outstanding examples of, you know, about as high risk as you can get, you know, high speed chases, shootouts, those kind of things, and successful, positive outcomes to those, where they're able to stop and neutralize a threat or stay on the vehicle that was trying to evade them and eventually apprehend them. So I wanted to show that, you know, this wasn't just one or two people that had kind of had a one-off experience, that, you know, there was actually a number of officers that had over a lengthy period of time,
right,
been able to police in comparable environments. And so ultimately I made all of my submissions through the internal grievance process.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking at going through National Human Rights Tribunal, but the feedback I got from them was I need to exhaust my internal avenues first before going to them, which makes sense, because otherwise they'd just be inundated with,
right,
with people's requests.
Everyone goes to the top, hey?
Yeah, exactly. Everyone wants to go right to them. So I had filed a grievance quite some time ago, and then it kind of came to a head where I had to make all of my submissions. So I put all my submissions forward, and this exclusively had to be done by writing. Towards the end of it, I'd actually gained quite a bit of support in headquarters where I was working when I was in the training unit. And they had actually tried to lobby for me to go in person to, right, Ottawa, to the National Policy Center, to speak,
yep,
in front of the National Medical Advisor. but the that request was denied. And I was a little frustrated with it, but I understood the reason for it. It was essentially because if they allowed me to go ahead in front of them and articulate myself and make my arguments verbally, then they would have to give that same concession to everyone else.
Right.
So it just wasn't feasible. So all my submissions had to be done by writing. Mm-hmm. So I drafted and drafted and redrafted, and I don't know how many drafts
I went through. So much work.
It was hundreds of pages of data, yeah. And dozens and dozens of redrafts on a lot of these things on certain sections, and I'm just trying to present my arguments as best as I could to show that this could be done.
Mm-hmm.
So, and by this point, I've been told no so many times.
Yeah.
So I made my final submissions. They went forward. The National Medical Advisor wrote a counter paper essentially saying this is why we still can't do this and why it's not feasible. I still didn't accept that. So I wrote a counter paper to her counter paper. And she's brilliant. She's got her PhD and everything else. And she's the head of the RCMPs. She's the National Medical Advisor. Like that's right. Not a small position.
No.
But yeah, I wrote a counter paper to her paper. And I wasn't adversarial. I wasn't trying to burn any bridges because that wouldn't do me any good.
No.
I tried to stay very kind of neutral, detached, but very factual. Mm-hmm. And objective and show, you know, in your paper in paragraph one, line two, you say this. However, in my paper, you know, paragraph three, line four, this actually counters that. And this data actually refutes that. And,
yeah,
you know, so I went through this lengthy draft and redraft process with the final submission on that end, or I guess the final submission to her counter paper. And then I didn't hear anything for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I was checking my email every day. I was getting really
edgy. You made them think. Now they have to really ponder.
Yeah, because this wasn't like the other times where I was just told no. Or I was told no shortly after. This kind of was going on and on and on. And I knew this was my last shot internally at resolving it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'd have to go to the National Human Rights Tribunal. And I was ready for that fight. But I also knew that was going to be years worth of...
Yeah.
Of process and procedure and litigation and everything else. So fast forward a few months, and the superintendent in charge of the Employee Management Relations Office, the MRO's office, started to kind of crack. I was in her office for another completely unrelated thing, and she started to say, you know, hey, I've kind of heard back from them. And just with what was going on, it wasn't the greatest time to bring that forward. I was just in there for a completely different thing. And then she kind of started to crack. You could tell, like, she's like, I know this isn't the time, but I really want to tell you sort of thing. And then I couldn't help myself. I'm like, you have to tell me. Like, come on. She's like, it's good. I'm like, so they're going to say yes. And then finally she just spilled it. And I literally broke into tears. And
well, I just started crying. Because what has been 4 years by that time, right?
4 years.
That you had been fighting and presenting and studying and getting to know.
Everything. Every single day.
No.
Every single day. I was at a friend's wedding in Mexico and I was at the gym.
Yeah.
Working out every day.
Yeah.
It was just this culmination of 4 years worth of work that finally paid off. And I remember calling the National Medical Advisor, Dr. José Pilon. I called her on the spot. Once I had, you know, stopped crying. I told her, like, hey, thank you. Thank you for letting me do this. I'm not going to let you down. I'm going to show you that you made the right decision. Because it was hard on their end too, because it wasn't... At one point, it shifted from, you know, is he able to do this versus, because that's kind of what it was initially. Like, no one, nobody, even my own friends, didn't think this could be done. A lot of people told me that, and I didn't want to hear that. But there were a number of people, and I kind of forced the answer out of them, and some people just flat out told me, no, I don't think you can do it.
Right.
And then it turned into, well, the force probably isn't going to let you, which was because of implications of liability and mm-hmm. the perception of liability and the public, the perceived public perception, or what they anticipated would be the perceived public perception to it,
mm-hmm.
and all these other things. So there was a lot riding on it.
Yeah.
Not just for me, but for the force as a whole, because whatever decision they made was going to have.
Because it wouldn't be a decision just for you.
No.
It's for the entire force, because they can't make an exception.
Correct. Yes. They couldn't just say, well, you and you only will get to do this. So
yeah.
when they did that, when they changed the policy, I was allowed to go back. Mm-hmm. And it also laid the framework based on all the submissions that I had given them, for the new standard, if you will. So if you lose vision in one eye, you know, you need to do this, do this, do this.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those things, all that was data that I had presented to them showing, hey, this is how it can be done.
Yeah, you like you said, you gave them the framework that they needed.
Yes.
You did all that legwork, which was fantastic. And now you not only changed it for you, but for any others that find themselves in a similar type of situation, right?
Yeah. And it's funny you say that, because when I called her and said, hey, because it wasn't even just her, it was her. It was, there were others at the policy center and the director general of occupational health and safety.
Mm-hmm.
And she told me, we all went through your submissions. You did our work for us.
We
didn't know about any of this. A lot of the stuff we didn't know about.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, you kind of made it easy for us.
Mm-hmm.
I still think it was difficult because of the ramifications or potential ramifications, but once they had that framework, they were good to go. It was something objective that they could rely on, not just, hey, I can do it. Look
right.
how well I can shoot, or look at all these scenarios that I can pass.
Yeah.
And then it allowed a number of other people to go back as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I was pretty happy with that. There's been a few actually that have returned to work since.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Because of the work that you had done?
Yep. So there's one guy in headquarters, He, I'll just give his first name. He knows who he is, Bruce.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Bruce was hit by a drunk driver much earlier in his career, and then was desked and then put kind of in a training role. And even he didn't think I'd be able to accomplish this.
Yeah.
And then I still remember the day I walked up to him and, hey, read this. And
wow.
It was the email of, he couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
So then he actually went back. He was going to retire.
Yeah.
And he had 34 years on the job. He was literally months away, I believe, from retirement.
Yeah.
And then he read it, and then not long after ended up telling me, I don't think I can retire yet. Like, you did all this.
Mm-hmm.
I think I need to go back to the road. So he ended up going through the standards that were laid out. He got through all that stuff, no issue, and then spent his last year on the road.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Hey?
And then there's a few others as well.
Yeah.
But that was stuff like that was probably the most rewarding.
I can imagine. Yeah. One of my takeaways from just listening to your story is this two things, and they both have to do with purpose. But when you know there's something in you for you to do, the drive that can come from that, because so many times, like you said, like, you could have given up and just stayed defeated, just drop it, you know, and people are telling you it's not going to work. Why are you putting in all the effort? Like, just, you know, save yourself the disappointment of the next no and just move on. But when you have something in you that you know is part of who you are and what you're supposed to be doing, there's this inner drive that doesn't really relent, right? It just...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's how I felt. Anytime I picture myself doing something different, I just couldn't,
mm-hmm.
I couldn't envision it.
Yeah.
I just couldn't see myself walking away and then going doing something else.
Yeah.
It was too much of who I was and what I wanted to continue to be.
Yeah.
So that definitely, I think, was a big driving factor behind it. And that success, like, there's no substitute for that. Like,
no.
The feeling of success, like, and that's something that I oftentimes did with myself, is I would picture myself becoming successful. I would literally envision it.
Right.
There's a term for it. It's called mental imagery. It's when you, when you essentially go through something in your mind and picture yourself doing it successfully and everything else. And it's that's a whole other discussion.
Oh, trust me.
But
I
it
know,
works.
Yeah.
It works.
Yeah.
I've done it with many different things. And yeah, with that, when I would picture myself succeeding at that, I was like, I can't let this go. I have to do this.
Yeah. I just love that drive. And sometimes while we're fighting our own battles, we don't realize the people that are actually watching us.
It's funny you say that, because there were some people that I knew were watching me.
Right.
At all sorts of different levels. Even once I got back operational, I still had to go in the field and prove it. And I knew every person at headquarters was watching. Because there was so many potential ramifications of what that would look like. Well, is it just good on paper, or is he actually good to go?
Mm-hmm.
But even outside of those people, those are the ones I knew were watching me. Those people and people who were close to me and everyone else. But I had people reach out to me that I hadn't seen in years, that I hadn't seen since Fort McMurray.
Right.
And some of them apologized. It just about brought me to tears. I had some of them apologize, saying, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I'm super happy that you're able to accomplish this. I couldn't be more pleased with you and happy with what you've done, and you should be proud of it and everything else. But I need to confess something. I didn't think you were going to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that you were wasting your time and that you could have done so much good somewhere else with doing something else.
Mm-hmm.
But I never had the heart to tell you.
Right.
I still remember that message, and that was a huge...
Yeah.
I wasn't even mad. I was like, you know what? That's amazing for you to tell me that. I had people calling me that had since moved to other parts of the country saying, I'm sorry that I told you that you weren't going to get back. I honestly didn't think you would.
Yeah.
And here you have, and I stand corrected. And, all power to you kind of thing.
Again, it was just coming back to that, the inner motivation that kept you going, because everything you went through, I mean, it was severely traumatic when you start to just break it down, even from the first time that you found out you had a tumor, and then, the likelihood is that, do you have 2 years? Do you have 10 years? Like, what's going on here? And then you're in this state of limbo, and then suddenly you get a new lease on life. Everything's going to be okay. So this up and down and everything, and then you're faced with this career that now seems like it's not going to happen anymore, and then the fight to keep going for that, and it's just pretty fantastic. And then the person Bruce,
yes,
and others who got to reap the benefits of all that work that you put in, and that's life changing for them.
It literally is life changing for some of them. There's another person, actually. I'll see if I can find the email, if you don't mind.
Yeah, go ahead.
I saved it because when my daughters are older, I'd like to show them. I kept a whole bunch of things along the way.
Yeah.
But there was another individual who... I apologize, I have it here. Here it is, I think. Nope, not there. Hang on. Here it is. I'm not going to read out this person's name. It's just not my place to do so.
Yeah.
But actually, you know what? I know where it is. I posted it on Facebook a while ago because it was pretty cool to see. Okay, so it starts off. Hi, Michael. My name is. I've been a member of the RCMP for the past 14 years, and just wanted to write you a quick email to say thank you. A year and a half ago, I woke up one morning without vision in my right eye.
Wow.
I suffered a retinal vein occlusion throughout the night. I didn't know what that was, and I kind of freaked out a little bit because I'm like, well, I don't want one of those.
Yeah.
So I Googled it, and it turns out that it's kind of like a blood clot or something to that effect that causes blindness in one eye. Thankfully, it's very rare. In any event, I was at a point in my career where I had just obtained my dream position in the RCMP with a certain unit. I just don't want to say where it is because it would pretty easily identify this person. Being told that my vision would most likely not return, I was devastated to think I could not be an operational member again. Some random Googling and looking up health services policies led me to your story. Over the past year and a half, it was your story that gave me hope that I could return as an operational member once again. I retrained and qualified on all intervention options, including learning to shoot long guns left-handed conducted an operational driving assessment, occupational skills training, and finally an operational skills evaluation where the health services doctor was present for my scenario-based assessments. Wow. So it's the RCMP doctor watching him go through all that. I just wanted to say thank you for the work you did and having the vision policy changed and giving me the hope that I could return to duty and put this uniform on again. Thank you and wow. Stay safe. Yeah, that was a huge gut check when I read that.
No kidding.
I've never met this guy. I came into work one day and I just was going through my emails and I read it and I was like, wow, that's...
Yeah.
That came out of nowhere.
And this is the impact that you've seen. How about the ones that that don't get in touch with you? You know, like you just never know the breadth, the width of the wake that you've left behind that's affecting so many people. Tell me, after your surgery, how long was it before you met your wife?
Oh, jeez. let's see here. It was... When was it? It was after my first one, it was my third, so it was after the craniotomy, and that was in, I want to say in the winter, I think. And then it was less than a year because I went to depo to requalify. Yeah, and do my mandatory. So that's why I went back to depo to re-qualify on everything. And I was running the para, which is kind of like a timed obstacle course. I didn't want the standard time. I wanted the superior time, which was a grind.
You needed to make a mark.
Yeah, I wanted to show, hey, I'm more than good to go.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of after hours running and practicing and training. And she had come in to do the same.
Yeah,
and she was just a kid at the time, and obviously my eye stands out a little bit, so we kind of got talking, and I never thought I'd see her again.
Mm-hmm.
So finished my training and I was like, all right, you know, see you around, kind of thing. And
she
said, hey, like, can we stay in touch? Like, I want to see how your thing plays out. Like, that's pretty cool that you're trying to do that and everything else. And then, ironically, she gets posted to Fort McMurray, where I was. And then, I had been talking with her right up until then.
Yeah.
I still had no idea. I was like, whatever. Like, I'll just, I'll just stay in touch with her. I mean, she's a nice girl and wants to see how this goes. And I'll kind of keep her posted on what I'm doing and everything else. And, sure enough, she comes to Fort McMurray and... Yeah, kind of just went from there.
Yeah, and the rest is history.
Yep.
Yeah, I love that so much. And I was like, I need to ask him about that because there's this like restoration in your life and you get a new lease on your health and then you get your career. And I'm like, well, when does the family come in there? Because, you know, when you were saying you might have 10 years to live, but then what do you do? Do you like it would feel selfish, you know, for some to get married and bring someone into a situation that wasn't going to be stable. And so, but now you were able to do that.
Yep.
And so when I introduced you as a husband and a father first, and then an RCMP sergeant, that I think is so special.
Absolutely.
And that's the key right there. I mean, the family unit and being able to have children and to have a wife and to have that life, is just so fulfilling.
It is. And it's definitely a shift I've noticed in myself. When I was younger, all I cared about was the job, whereas now I've learned to balance that a lot better. It's it's family first, then the job.
Yeah.
But having a family, being a father, being a husband also gives you some qualities that help you to do the job better in a lot of ways.
Right. Very interesting.
Yeah. Interesting too that had I not gone through that fight, never would have met her.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah, because I ended up getting transferred shortly after she came to Fort McMurray. So we ended up dating long distance for a while. But yeah, I probably wouldn't have met her because she would have come in as a new recruit. And I was in the criminal intelligence unit at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of stashed off in a broom closet sort of thing because they didn't quite know what to do with me. Well, because they had offered me a whole bunch of federal units. Like, hey, like, these are some places that would be a lot better to accommodate you with, you know, the vision loss and doing administrative work. A lot of these units, specialized units, are, you know, more administratively based because they're long-term projects and things like that. You've got the skill sets from what you've been doing in drug sections. So, and it was kind of funny because I still remember telling them, like, no, I just want to go back to work.
Right.
And they didn't know what to do with me because they're not used to hearing that.
Yeah. Yeah. And so now you and your wife are both officers.
Correct. Yes.
Which is pretty cool too. I mean, I'm a civilian, you know, but I think that's pretty neat. That's a lot to balance, I'm sure.
Yes.
With shift work and all of that. A question for the general public.
Sure.
Seeing as you're both officers, but you're both working different units type, right? Yeah. Different jobs, basically. Do you have stuff that you can't talk to her about, and she has stuff that she can't talk to you about?
Not really. The only time something like that would ever come in would be if I was involved or supervising kind of like a critical incident where officers had some sort of potential jeopardy, let's say. So just an example of that, let's say I'm supervising and an officer shooting happens.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that information could be, or most likely would have to be withheld depending on what I knew and the context in which I knew it. Same with her. So I guess in short, there are some circumstances where we wouldn't be able to talk about work, but not very many.
It's not super common.
No.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
That makes things a little simpler. Yeah. So, I want to talk about the person that feels that thing inside them that they want to do. They have this dream. They sense purpose in their life, but stuff has happened and they want to give up. What would you say after walking what you've walked?
There's a couple things that come to mind with that. The first, and I'll tell this to anyone, anyone who's been hard done by, I would never take that away from them, but nothing's going to change that. No one's going to change it for them.
Right.
And you might've had a really bad hand of cards dealt to you, but if you don't get up and change it, no one's going to do it for you. So as much as it might suck to have that, you need to do it yourself.
Yeah.
And if you quit, you guarantee that you won't have that success.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how unlikely it is otherwise. And kind of the other part to that is it's okay to fail. You're going to fail. You're going to fail many, many times. There were so many times where I was like, this is it. I'm done. They're not going to let me do it. I'm not going to succeed. I'm not going to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
I'm never going to get what I'm working towards. And then I'd have my little pity party and then I would move on from it. I'd push it away. I'd get up and I'd tell myself, no, that's not how it's going to go. I'm going to get up. I'm going to do this. They're not going to stop.
Yeah.
And it's almost cyclical. Like you can't help but fall down, but then you have to get up every time.
Right. So then it's like, you can't stay in a victim mindset.
No, or it's going to haunt you for the rest of your life. I mean, if I stayed in that mindset, if I got into that mindset and stayed there, I mean, it's been almost 10 years now since I've had cancer. I would still be kicking myself had I not gone through. Not to mention, I probably wouldn't have met my wife, and I wouldn't have my kids and all these other, like, my life would have been completely different.
Yeah.
And certainly not for the better.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas now I have something that I've worked really, really hard towards, that I was successful at, that I can, I never thought I would do this, but I would show my kids when they're older. I wasn't even thinking that when I was going through it, but looking at it now, there's so many lessons that I learned through that process that I could show them. Hey, here's this email. Hey, here's this, you know, picture of me training and doing all this stuff when everything seemed hopeless, and all these things that I was doing. And hey, here's the result of all that hard work. Hard work pays off.
Mm-hmm. And there's not a lot of people that I know of who have worked as hard and pushed as hard and not given up so many times to get where you are today. And I think about your kids. I've been thinking about your little girls and thinking what a treasure there is for that, for them in that. Mm-hmm. Like you said, you have just this treasure trove of experience and wisdom for them to draw on. And what a gift that is to them. So your tenacity is a blessing in your home, but it's so much further reaching than that too. And you are inspiring. You're inspiring, and the hope that it sparks hope.
Thank you.
For other people. And I love the don't quit, don't be in a victim mentality. You said earlier, don't burn your bridges. Yeah. And when I hear you talking about your story, the opportunity that you had to be bitter, I'm not saying you never were, but to stay bitter, to stay angry, to stick it to the man, right? You're saying, no, I'm going to the media. You know how people they just kind of lose it, right?
Absolutely.
But so many people would have justified that for you.
Yeah. I had some people telling me to do that.
Yeah.
And emotionally, I wanted to. Emotionally, right. I just wanted to yell at some of these people. And
yeah.
I was so mad at them at times, but, then I would pull myself back. I would look at it objectively, and there was no value to any of that.
Mm-hmm.
If I became adversarial, it only would have hindered me in what I was doing.
Yeah.
And even though they were saying no, they weren't doing so out of any sort of malicious ill intent. It was just, I almost feel like I was a victim of circumstance more than anything
right.
in a sense, because you look at, the policies and the perceptions that they were having and all these things. I definitely think it could have been handled a little bit differently, yeah. and I think it should have, but I mean, that's neither here nor there, and it's not going to change anything.
Mm-hmm.
But getting angry like that and not being able to regulate your emotions and mm-hmm. not going to do you any good. It's just going to make it worse.
And I actually think a lot of people need to hear that.
Yeah.
I went through a divorce as well for several years in and out of the court system. And I was my own lawyer mm-hmm. for a lot of that. And I learned very quickly, you mind your emotions.
Yep.
It's not even that the judge is impatient or unkind, but your emotions mean nothing to him. He needs the facts. He needs the figures. He needs the times. He needs the dates.
Yep.
So if you want something, you better give him what he needs to be able to make a decision. And
that's very true.
As soon as you blow up, as soon as you lose it and start blubbering, or you get angry and you might want to cut off the other lawyer mid-sentence because that's a lie, but inside you're screaming this, right? But you lose the respect of the judge. So in life, with everything, if you're acting impulsively on your emotions, you're burning bridges, you're not making a good impression on anybody. And you're likely communicating really, really poorly.
Yes. And by doing so, I remember coming to this self-realization very early on that if I start yelling, kicking and screaming and demanding,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to discredit myself because
yeah.
I'm going to look like some rogue cop who at whatever cost is going to get back. And if I behave that way, all this objective information that I give them is going to be scrutinized.
Yeah.
And they're going to question the legitimacy of that information. And
mm-hmm.
it's just going to be harder for me.
Yeah.
Whereas if I can just keep it, keep myself neutral, keep myself objective, factual, pull the emotions out of it, they're going to take what I say with a lot more seriousness than if I'm saying things out of anger or frustration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So good. Well, we're going to wrap it up.
Sure.
So thankful that you took the time to come and share your story, and just the hope that people are going to hear in that, and the tenacity. Like, there's so many nuggets for people to take away and just practically start applying it to their own lives and their own situations. And I think bottom line, when you know there's something for you to do, don't give up.
Absolutely.
Right? Just keep pushing in, find the answers. And I love you disciplined yourself. You went and learned what you need to learn to accomplish what you needed to accomplish. And oftentimes we want things to fall into our lap. We just want it to work out. If I cry a little bit over here, maybe, you know, yeah. Like, but you have to put in the work. It's not just being persistent in your mind. It's in your actions. You follow through.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's no quick fix. There's no, yeah. Oh, just do this one magical thing, this one moment.
Yeah.
No, it's going to be a culmination of all these different things you do to be successful.
Yeah, 100%. So thank you. And I just pray the Lord's richest blessings on you your kids and your wife, your career. I can't wait to see what's next, where you go from here.
Me too.
Thanks so much.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Made on Purpose. If you enjoyed today's episode, please be sure to follow, subscribe, and share so that we can share this story with others. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.